sound with her throat melting away like it was, but Finn's ears rang with the sound of her excruciation. Acrid, stinging white smoke poured from Adeline's dissolving face, filling the room. It burned Finn's throat and eyes, making him cough and retch. Temporarily blind, Finn stumbled into the cavernous bedroom, feeling his way as he went. He flailed his arms in front of him, trying to stay balanced. He didn't see Adeline's spindly dressing table chair, but he surely felt it when he collided with it. He said, "Ooh," then his legs buckled and he collapsed on the floor at the foot of the bed, disoriented and unable to see. He heard Christina screaming his name, but, still smoke-blind, he didn't understand why. And he couldn't see what they saw until it was long past too late. The old man in black streaked toward Finn with the speed of a deadly underwater snake. Christina screamed Finn's name as she saw the man's black-robed arms with their long-fingered white hands uncoil from his sides and seize the boy in a possessive grip, yanking Finn back towards him, enfolding him in his arms. He slipped his elbow around Finn's throat in a crushing chokehold. Finn's face turned a dull, airless red as he began to suffocate. As he dragged Finn towards the French doors leading to Adeline's balcony, the old man's eyes met Morgan's. "Let him go!" she screamed. "Let Finn go!" Christina shouted, "Morgan, stay away from him!" But if Morgan could hear at all, she gave no sign of it. She launched herself at the old man, her fists raised. But she never reached him or Finn. Finn's face was the color of the dark pink flush of an overripe peach, and his eyes bulged and watered from lack of oxygen. He reached out one arm and choked out one ragged, pleading word that sounded like Morgan at the same time as Morgan reached out to him, fully intending to wrench Finn from the old man's death grip. Their fingers brushed once. Then the old man threw himself back against the closed French doors. The glass shattered around him in his wake, and the momentum sent them tumbling over the edge of the balcony 30 feet above the ground. Clouds of wet snow and cold rain blew into the bedroom from the broken doors and the night outside, curtains flapping into the room like flags. But instead of the sound of their bodies striking the lawn below, Morgan heard the sound of giant wings churning the air outside the window, and Finn screaming her name over and over again. When she ran to the balcony and tried to follow the sound, Morgan saw a great dark mass, nearly indistinguishable from the general blackness, rising into the night sky. She might have missed it entirely, except for the helplessly flailing figure of a small, screaming boy in white pajamas it carried in its claws, growing smaller and smaller as they drifted almost lazily into the deeper darkness towards the outlying forests and the cliffs beyond. Then it was swallowed up entirely by the rain and the sheets of snow. Adeline Parr's bedroom reeked of blood and acid smoke. Christina stood up carefully, but spears of white sharp pain still shot up her left leg from the impact of her collision. Her head throbbed. Morgan, her hair wet with melting snow, stood on the balcony, wailing Finn's name over and again. Adeline Parr's headless body was motionless on the carpet. Where her head had been, there was only a nimbus of boiled slush and bits of stubborn bone fragment that had survived the annihilation of the holy water. Christina had a great longing to kick the body as hard as she could, but there was still some lingering fear in her that even now Adeline would reach out and grasp her ankle, diamond rings and red lacquered scimitar fingernails digging into Christina's soft skin. Instead, She stepped over Adeline's body and went to the gory tangle of silk sheets where Jeremy had bled out and died. Christina couldn't breathe. She looked down at the familiar face, so much like Jack's, and felt a band of grief tighten around her chest so strongly that she feared she might literally suffocate from the pain of this second tragic severing from their lives, of the second of the two men who had meant the most to her and Morgan. "Oh, Jeremy," she thought. "Oh, my poor, sweet Jeremy, what did they do to you?" Christina pulled one of the sheets out from under him, a cleaner one than the others, at least, and carefully and lovingly covered his broken and torn body with it. As she did, a glitter of silver on the carpet caught her eye. It was Jeremy's St. Christopher medal. The chain was broken, as though it had been ripped off his neck and thrown down. Christina bent and picked it up. She put it in the pocket of her jeans. By the window, Morgan had stopped calling Finn's name, but her body still shook with sobs. Her shoulders were hunched forward, and her hands were loosely clasped in front of her as though praying. Christina called out softly, "Morgan, honey?" Morgan turned around. Her face was white and stiff with shock. "Hi, Mom," she said. "What did you say?" "Mom, he took Finn. He carried Finn away." Fresh tears streamed from her eyes. "There really are vampires, just like Finn said there were. It was all true." She shook her daughter gently. "Morgan, we have to leave," Christina said, struggling to keep her voice calm without sacrificing the force of her words, words she needed Morgan to hear and heed. "We have to leave right now. Are you okay to walk? Can you make it downstairs to the car?" "But what about Finn?" She stared frantically through the broken French doors. "Morgan, listen to me," she said urgently. "We have to leave the house. It's too dangerous here. We can't worry about Finn now. Finn would want you safe." "Okay," Morgan said. She glanced down at Jeremy's body on the bed and started to shake again. "Oh, Mom. Don't look at it, Morgan. Don't look at him. Come on now, here, look at me instead. Look at my face." When she did, Christina smiled encouragingly. "That's it. Just keep your eyes on me." She put her arm around Morgan's shoulders and gently herded her past the carnage in the bedroom and out into the hallway. Once there, she hurried her daughter down the stairs. The keys to the Chevelle were where she'd left them, on the console table near the front door, next to her purse. The only light downstairs came from the embers of the fire in Adeline's study bleeding through the half-closed doors, and a green-shaded library lamp on the other side of the hallway. Christina took one last look back at the foyer of Parr House, which seemed to have gorged itself on the darkness, both natural and unnatural, until it was bloated. Whatever the source of the monsters that seemed to have stepped out of the storybooks and into her world, they had all been drawn here, to Parr's Landing and to this awful place. Nothing could live here. Could ever have lived here, she corrected herself, except anguish and misery. Christina wished she had a can of propane and a match. She thought briefly of looking for just that in one of the pantries off the kitchen, but she realized that there just wasn't time. Every moment she remained in this house, they were in danger. She had to get Morgan to safety, whatever safety meant in the middle of this horror. "Come on, sweetheart," Christina said. "Let's go. We never have to come back to this place again." Chapter 26. The Gold Nugget Motel was dark when Christina pulled into the parking lot in the snow. The Chevelle's headlights played across the windows of the diner, illuminating empty tables and shining through empty water glasses that went dark again when the high beams veered away as she parked the car. Morgan opened the passenger side door and looked around fearfully. "Mom, what are we doing here? Where is this place?" She leaned close to her mother, away from the snow and rain that was now falling in an even mixture of both. "It's the motel, Morgan," Christina said, with a calmness she didn't feel. "It's the Nugget. It's where Billy is staying." She stepped out and locked the car, realizing at once what a futile gesture it was. If those things wanted to get in somewhere, they seemed to just do it. They didn't ask questions or worry much about locks. "At some point, when I can think about it without going insane, I must take some time to sit down and consider the fact that my gay brother-in-law was just killed by his mother. Oh, but it gets better. He was killed by his mother, who drank his blood and then bit his cock off with teeth the size of fingers, then spat it out. At which point a 12-year-old friend of my daughter's threw a jar of holy water in the bitch's face and melted it right off because he'd read it in a vampire comic. Then, wait for it, my daughter's friend was carried off by an old man dressed like a 17th-century Jesuit priest in one of our history books from school. I'm living in a monster movie, which is crazy, of course. But crazy or not, here we are. And it's dark, and I'm cold, and there's no one anywhere around here who can help me except a man I barely know. And if I think about any of this right now, I'll go right off my goddamn head." She reached for Morgan's hand and pulled her along as quickly as she could. "We need to find him quickly. Let's hope he left his room unlocked. It'll give us a place to stay where it's safe, at least for now."
"What if he's not here?
What if we have to go back to Grandmother's house?" "Morgan, we're not going back there to that house ever, no matter what. If Billy's not here, I'll kick the door in if I have to." In the absence of light from any of the rooms, let alone the diner or the front office, Christina tried to recall which room Billy had entered when she dropped him off 1,000 years ago this afternoon. She hadn't been paying attention, of course, because at that time, she and reality still shared mutually agreed upon parameters. Christina and Morgan stopped in front of room 938. "This is the one, I think," Christina said, trying the doorknob. It was locked, of course, and the room was dark as all the others. "Jesus Christ!" she shouted, kicking the door in frustration. Christina thought for a moment, then said, "Morgan, stay right here. I'm going to break into the office and get the spare key."
"Mom, no, are you kidding me? I'm not waiting out here."
"You're right, it was a stupid idea. Forget it. Come with me, but stay close, Morgan, I mean it." The office, as it turned out, was not locked. It wasn't even closed. The office door banged in the wind. A cold cup of coffee sat atop the front desk, and the floor was littered with shards of broken light bulb glass. Her foot slipped in a pool of something sticky and dark that she couldn't see, but which smelled like dirty pennies. She wondered what had happened to Darcy Moran, then decided that she couldn't bear the knowledge right now anyway. "Morgan, step back, please," Christina said, blocking the entrance to the office with her body. "Stay in the doorway here, but don't come in. But stay close enough for me to grab you, okay, honey?"
"Mom, what is it?"
she asked fearfully. "What's in there?"
"Nothing, honey. Just looking for the key to Billy's room."
Privately, she was grateful for the darkness. There was nothing she might stumble upon here in the office that she had any desire to see in the light. Under her breath, she muttered, 935, 936, aha, got it. She took the key to room 938 down off the peg and stepped outside, taking Morgan by the arm.
"Come on, honey, let's get warm. Hurry, hurry, hurry."
Outside, she slipped the key into the lock of room 938. Blessedly, there was a click. She pushed the door open and stepped into the warmth of Billy's room, which smelled of leather and pipe tobacco and kindness. And when she switched on the light, it revealed nothing out of the ordinary. Billy found them in his motel room an hour later, with the doors barricaded from the inside, a chair wedged up against the handle. He peered in through his window. Christina was sitting on the bed with her knees up. Morgan was in her arms, leaning with her head on her mother's breast. Morgan's eyes were closed, but Billy doubted she was sleeping. Christina's eyes were trained on the door, wide open and alert. In her hands was some sort of silver medal on a chain. Billy could spot a St. Christopher's medal at 30 paces. All of the children at St. Rita's were given one, and had been expected to wear it all the time. Ironic, Billy thought. For the first time in my life, it would have come in handy. He looked down at his clothes and wondered what sort of a picture he would present if he knocked on the door of his own motel room and asked Christina to let him in. Not a good one, he expected. He stank, and his clothes were covered with dirt and blood. He looked down at his hands, which were the color of coal dust. I could just leave them in there and not knock. They'd probably be safe. Then he shook his head and sighed. Of course they wouldn't be safe in there. They're completely unsafe in there. He knocked on the motel room door and called out, Christina! From inside, Christina's muffled voice. Billy, is that you? Yeah, it's me, he said. Let me in. Christina opened the door and fell into Billy Lightning's arms. She hadn't intended to fall into his arms, or any man's arms, especially not in front of Morgan. But the momentum of her own relief propelled her. Billy was solid and real and reassuring, and his presence was warm and strong. Christina was tired of being the strong one, and she was dead tired of being afraid. Billy, what's that smell? She pulled away, wrinkling her nose in distaste. Her eyes widened as she took in his appearance. Jesus, what happened? Were you in an accident? Are you all right? He stepped back, away from her. Sorry, I should have warned you about that. Look, he said, pointing at her, I've gotten you dirty. He reached out to brush the smear of dirt off her pale pink sweater. Here, let me. Christina's eyes darted to Morgan on the bed, who was watching their interaction with wide eyes, silently. Christina shook her head almost undetectably at Billy, who understood. No, I've got it, thanks, she said, brushing the ash off the sweater herself. Of course, he said politely. Yeah, that's it. There, you've got it. She smiled, grateful for his understanding. Billy, what happened to you? When you weren't here, we took the key from the front office. Mr. Marin wasn't there. No one was there. The whole place is empty. Marin is down at the old hockey arena, he said. The one on Brandon Nixon Road. So are Elliot and Sergeant Thompson and about 30 other residents of Parr's Landing. Christina was confused. What do you mean they're at the arena? She shook her head. The old arena? The Tac-X one? Is that even still standing? Elliot and Jack used to play there. It burned down. It's a ruin. It's more than a ruin, Christina, Billy said. It's a grave. Billy, what are you talking about? He glanced at Morgan, then back at Christina. Maybe not here. Outside? From the bed, Morgan's voice was surprisingly strong and clear. Dr. Lightning, she said. Finn's dead. Uncle Jeremy's dead. I saw it happen with my very own eyes. Please tell my mom what you're talking about. I'm never going to forget the things I saw tonight, and words aren't going to scare me. Billy sighed. Okay. Fair enough. I found the place they were all, sleeping. He faltered, looking helplessly to Christina for help, adult to adult. The vampires, Morgan finished impatiently. Her face was pale and hard, her mouth set in a steely line Christina had never seen before. Finn said they were vampires. He knew what they were, but nobody believed him because we all thought he was just a dumb kid who read Tomb of Dracula comics. And now he's dead, she added flatly. And it's our fault. And now we believe him. And now it's too late.
Okay, vampires, Billy said. I found them there. It was everything Finn said it would be. Also, I found Richard Wheel. I was right. He killed my father and stole his manuscript. Wheel said he came here to wake someone up, someone who had been sleeping here in the caves. Those voices in 1952? He wasn't imagining them. They were real. Probably all the people who heard them were really hearing them.
The priest, Christina said suddenly. He looked like a priest, the one who carried Finn away.
What priest? What are you talking about?
Christina replied, they killed Jeremy, him, and Adeline. When we found him in Adeline's room, there was someone else there, an old man. I'd never seen him before. He was in a long black robe. I remember thinking he looked like a picture of one of the Jesuit martyrs in the church here, the ones who came here to settle, the ones who died here 300 years ago.
Billy said, figures it would be a goddamn priest. Morgan watched Billy carefully. She said nothing, but every nerve in her body was stretched as taut as wire. Something about him wasn't right. He was different. Maybe not different like Adeline was different, afterwards. Not quite, anyway. But she wished he wasn't standing so close to her mother.
We need to get you to someplace safe, Billy said, at least until dawn. Then you have to leave. You have to leave Parr's Landing. You have to drive back to Toronto, and you have to not look back. Never, ever come back here, Christina. I mean it.
I don't think the car will survive the trip, Billy. Adeline's chauffeur has the keys to her car, and he and his wife are missing, too. And Jeremy said he found some money in Adeline's room, but he didn't give it to me before he... well, before what happened.
Billy fished in his pockets and handed Christina the keys to his truck. Take the Ford, he said. It's practically new. It'll get you home to Toronto. And there's about $700 in the glove box. Take it. Just promise me you'll go. Get Morgan away from here.
You mean we, don't you?
You don't mean without you, do you, Billy?
Billy's expression was unreadable.
I can't leave, he said.
What do you mean you can't leave? Are you kidding me?
Hysteria made Christina's voice shrill and jagged.
You can leave. You have to leave. There's nothing here for you. Nothing!
Wheel came here because of my father, Billy said. All these people are dead because of him. We brought Wheel here in 1952 and put this all in motion. The arena was full of those things when I got there tonight. Who knows how many of them there are here, or what they'll do?
I can't leave. I have to fix this. I have to find the one who did this and make it right. For my father's sake, at the very least. But I won't be able to do it unless I know that you and Morgan are safe and a long way from here.
When she started to protest, Billy put up his hand. No more talk, he said. Get Morgan ready. I'll bring the truck right to the entrance here. I'm taking you to the church. When the sun comes up, leave. Don't look back.
Dr. Lightning, Morgan said, may I ask you a question?
What is it, honey?
You said that they were in the arena when you got there. How did you get away?
I burned them, Billy said. I burned their bodies. Just like Finn said, fire hurts them. Morgan sounded dubious. You don't smell like smoke, and they just let you?
They weren't awake yet, he said vaguely. Not all of them, anyway. I guess the sun wasn't all the way down. Don't worry, I took care of it. Now, he said, no more talking. We need to get you two to the church. He held up his hand again. I mean it. No more questions, he said gruffly. It's time to go, ladies. He's lying, Morgan thought. But Christina was already pushing her out the door of the motel, and Billy had sprinted ahead and was standing by the door of the truck. Billy drove the short distance between the Gold Nugget and the church in complete silence, looking neither left nor right. The beams of the truck's headlights carved a tunnel through the shadows and the snow, which had grown thick and heavy in the hours since they'd arrived at the motel. On either side of the road, houses like empty husks took momentary shape, then vanished back into the night and the falling snow. Billy parked the truck in front of St. Bartholomew and the Martyrs. The steps leading to the front door and the sanctuary were packed in wet snow. Gusts of it capered in the yellow light above the entrance to the church. End of the line, he joked. This is where everyone gets off. Billy? Mom, come on! Morgan's voice was urgent. She didn't look at Billy. She opened the side door of the truck and jumped out. She grabbed at her mother's arm and practically pulled her out. I want to be in the church right now. Please! Morgan, you go on inside, Christina said, shaking off Morgan's hand on her arm. Wait for me. I want to talk to Billy for a minute. Mom, no! Now! Morgan shouted. I'm not going in without you. Don't talk to him. We don't have time. Morgan stared defiantly at Billy. He looked back at her. Wordless communication passed between them. Then Billy looked away. She's right, Christina, Billy said finally. Go inside where you'll be safe. It's open. Get some sleep, then tomorrow, take my truck and go. Christina pleaded. Stay with us. Come inside and wait until sunrise, then leave with us in the morning. There's nothing for you here. Mom, please! Goodbye, Christina, Billy said. I have to go back. He stepped away from the church, out of the ring of light, and walked into the shadows beyond it. A trick of the lamplight, Christina thought. I can still see his eyes. Then Billy Lightning was swallowed wholly by the darkness. Morgan woke to the sound of rocks falling on the stained glass windows. The sound startled her, and she sat up. Then she remembered. Oh, yes, she thought. We're in the church. They can't get us here. That's why we're here. She looked at her watch. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. Dawn was still 3 hours away. Beside her, Christina moaned softly in her sleep and turned over. She's dreaming, Morgan realized. She reached out and gently touched Christina's blonde hair. Her mother's eyes were ringed with blue-black circles, and the skin on either side of her nose was dull red and raw in the dim overhead lights of the church. Christina looked exhausted. Morgan wondered why she hadn't noticed it before. Then she realized why. Christina hadn't wanted her to see it. Her mother had been trying to protect her in every possible way since they'd arrived in Parr's Landing. But in sleep, the lie failed and her face told the truth. The scattershot of stones on glass came again. Morgan reached over and shook her mother's arm. Mom? Mom, wake up. There's someone outside. I'm scared.
But Christina slept on, oblivious. Morgan held the St. Christopher's medal tightly in her hands. The silver was warm and comforting somehow. The rocks came again, this time harder and more insistent. She ran to the window and tried to see outside, but it was impossible. This time the stones bounced off the glass directly in front of her.
Go away, she screamed. Leave us alone.
The voice that answered her was as clear as water. A soft voice. A boy's voice.
Morgan, it's me, Finn. Come outside. Finn? She cried joyously. Is that you? Are you okay?
It's me, Morgan, he said. I'm okay. Come outside.
I can't, Finn, she said. I'm not allowed.
Finn's voice was impatient.
Come to the front door of the church anyway. I'll be on the front steps.
Morgan looked at Christina sleeping on the pew.
Mom, she whispered. Mom, wake up. Can you hear me?
There was no answer. Christina slept on.
Finn's here. I'm going to go and see him. I'll be right back. Is it okay?
She won't even know I was gone, Morgan rationalized. I'll be back before she wakes up.
Finn's alive. Finn's alive.
She walked the length of the nave and opened the church doors wide to welcome Finn back. Finn stood on a small rise of accumulated snow on the lawn of the church. His feet looked frail and blue in the light, and there was no disturbance in the snow leading in any direction to or from where he stood. The wind whipped his dark hair about his face, and the fabric of the pajamas billowed ludicrously around his thin body. Morgan stared.
Finn? Is that you? What are you doing there? It's freezing. Come in here where it's warm.
Yeah, it's me, he said ruefully. I'm always coming to you, aren't I? I wish I was older so I could have been your boyfriend. Then I could have taken care of you.
Finn, what are you talking about? You did take care of me. You saved me from my grandmother back at the house. You saved my life.
He went on as though he hadn't heard her. You're really pretty, Morgan. He looked like he could be blushing, but in the light, it was hard to tell. Can I tell you something? He sounded gently embarrassed, but didn't wait for her to answer.
I love you, Morgan.
I guess I have from the moment I saw you outside the school that day.
Oh, Finn.
Morgan's eyes filled with tears.
I'm so sorry I wasn't a better friend to you. I'm so sorry.
He paused.
You know, right? You know what happened to me?
Morgan shook her head. But even as she did so, she realized she did know. She nodded, not trusting herself to speak. The tears that had been brimming in her eyes spilled down her cheeks.
He took me away, Finn said darkly. He took me to the caves up by Spirit Rock. He changed me. To punish me. You know, for what I did. You know, with the holy water.
Finn shivered.
He did awful things to me up there, he said. He's terrible, Morgan. He's so old. He's been waiting up there for hundreds of years, waiting for someone to wake him up. Someone did. Some crazy person. That day I found his bag with all the knives in it, that was his, for waking him up.
Morgan glanced back towards the church doors, feeling a sudden stab of fear. She clapped her hands over her ears to block out the sound of Finn's voice.
This isn't Finn, dummy. It used to be, but it isn't now. He's something, well, something else, like Grandmother Parr was.
But then Grandmother was sort of like that even before, wasn't she? Finn sighed.
I'm the same person, Morgan. I'm not going to hurt you. I promise. And you were hearing me in the church, even though I was outside, so don't bother covering your ears.
Morgan's voice quivered. She pointed through the open doors into the nave.
My mother is in there. She's sleeping.
Your mom won't wake up till I want her to. She's just asleep, don't worry. You won't hurt her either, you promise?
Your mom is a nice lady, Finn said, sounding wounded. She was nice to me. I would never hurt her.
He smiled, showing the small, pearlescent fangs of a 12-year-old boy on the edge of manhood, a state he would never attain.
She was nice to me. Of course I won't hurt her.
I needed to see you before...
Before what? She demanded.
He was silent, unmoving from his spot atop the mound of snow.
It hurts, Finn said.
His voice was small and hollow, even where it echoed inside her head.
It hurts something awful. Not like I thought it would be. In my comics, the vampires forget about their lives, and they stop feeling bad about it. Not me. I remember everything. And I still miss my dog. Sadie tried to protect me from this. She knew what was waiting up here.
Morgan was trembling. She wrapped her arms around her torso and rubbed them, trying to warm herself.
You're cold, Finn said. You should go inside.
I don't need to go inside.
But is it okay if I run inside quickly and get my sweater? Do you want to come inside and get warm?
I can't, Finn said. I can't go in there.
Why not?
Then she thought about it.
Oh, right, she said. Sorry.
Morgan realized she should feel safer knowing Finn couldn't cross the threshold of the church, but instead, it just made her feel sad.
I'll be right back, she promised.
She knew he could probably stop her if he wanted to, but he just said,
okay,
and shrugged. Morgan hurried up the nave to the place where Christina was still fast asleep, if anything, in a deeper sleep than before. The dark circles under Christina's eyes seemed to have faded by degrees, as though Finn were actually healing her mother from where he stood on top of the snow outside the church.
I could stay in here and never come out.
She picked up her sweater from where it lay on the back of the pew.
I could leave him out there in the cold and the snow and the night and never have to see him again. These things can't come into churches. But he's not a thing, is he? He's Finn. He's my friend. He saved my life.
Morgan saw the St. Christopher's medal lying on the pew next to her mother. She picked it up and slipped it into her pocket.
There's a house over there, Finn said, pointing across the snowy lawn after Morgan returned with her sweater.
Behind the manse.
It's empty. Do you want to go in there?
What for? Morgan said, suddenly fearful again.
Because it's cold out here, dummy, obviously, Finn teased.
And even if I'm not cold, you are.
I can tell.
You're still shivering.
I know you have that medal in your pocket. You could use it if you wanted. I wouldn't be able to stop you. Besides, I told you not to worry.
Morgan's voice was incredulous.
How do you know all this stuff?
Finn shrugged again, but this time it was a self-conscious shrug.
Some of it from the Tomb of Dracula, some of it from Dark Shadows, some of it from...
From him. He steals people's memories, then he shares them with us.
The rest of it I just know.
He tapped his chest and his head.
I know it in here.
I don't know how, I just do. She thought about it for a moment, then said,
okay, let's go to the house.
How do you know it's empty, or that it's open? He glanced briefly at the dark window on the second floor.
Trust me, I've been inside already.
The living room was plain, but clean. There was a photograph of Pope Paul VI on the wall above the television set, but no books anywhere. The unmistakable odor of boiled cabbage clung to the cheap curtains, indeed had seeped into every porous surface in the living room. Morgan hated boiled cabbage, especially the way it smelled when it was cooking. At that moment, however, it reminded her of her neighborhood in Toronto, and she just felt homesick. Sitting next to her on the plastic-covered sofa, Finn said shyly, "Morgan, can I ask you a question?" Her voice was gentle but teasing. "That's one question already, Finnegan." "My mom called me that," he said. "What was the question you wanted to ask me?" He hesitated. "Have you ever, well, have you ever, you know, like, had a boyfriend? Is that what you're asking? If I've ever had a boyfriend?" If he could blush, Morgan thought, he'd be beet red. Mutely, Finn nodded his head. "Have you ever had a girlfriend, Finn?" He shook his head. "Nope." "Why not?" She took his hand lightly in hers, finding it ice cold. "Have you ever liked a girl before?" "Only you," he said, looking down. "Never before. Nobody else." She brought his hand up to her face and laid it there. He leaned forward clumsily to kiss her on the lips, but missed, landing the kiss on her chin instead. Morgan inclined her head and kissed him tentatively on the lips. Blood thundered in Morgan's ears and her face flamed. "Finn, just so you know, I never... well, I've never had a boyfriend, either." Finn pulled away as though burned. "I'm sorry," he said. "I'm such a jerk. Why would a girl like you want to kiss somebody as ugly as me? I'm sorry," he said again. "I'm so stupid." Morgan sat very still, as though considering. Then she unbuttoned the top button of her cardigan. Then the second. Finn watched, his eyes wide. "Finn?" In the dark living room, Morgan's voice sounded alien, even to her. Thicker. Fuller. Almost a woman's voice now. Outside, the wind picked up, blowing thick fistfuls of snow at the windows. Morgan shrugged the sweater off her shoulders, letting it fall behind her on the sofa. "What?" Finn breathed. "You're not ugly. You were never ugly."
"I'm not?"
"No," Morgan said, reaching for him. "You're really not. You're really beautiful to me, Finnegan."
She hesitated, then said,
"Finn?"
"What?"
"Do you promise, really promise, that you won't hurt me?"
"I promise, Morgan," Finn said. "Cross my heart." They held each other close, naked in the makeshift bed of ottoman cushions and crocheted Afghan blankets on the floor of the immaculate, chaste house that smelled like boiled cabbage and carpet deodorizer, under the photograph of Pope Paul VI. Morgan had asked Finn if he wanted to go upstairs, but he seemed to panic at the thought, insisting instead they stay in the living room. When she asked him why, he shook his head and said, "Here is good. Here is fine." Later, in her arms, Finn's icy body didn't warm, but neither did Morgan's body catch the cold from Finn's and chill in sympathetic response. They tempered each other, explored each other's bodies with their hands and mouths, wondering at the bevy of sensations aroused as each touched the other in places they'd never been touched before.
"Morgan," Finn whispered in her ear when they were finished, "would you stay with me?" "We're leaving in the morning," she murmured. "I can't stay here."
"No," he said. His voice was ineffably sad.
"I mean just for a little bit longer. Just for tonight. I just don't want to be alone." Morgan leaned up on her elbow and looked at him quizzically.
What do you mean? Of course I'll stay with you tonight. Why? I mean, what else would I do?
Just a bit longer, Finn said, gazing out the living room window at the lightening eastern sky. Morgan realized she must have dozed off, because when she opened her eyes, Finn was kneeling at her side, shaking her arm with nearly violent desperation.
Morgan, Finn said urgently, wake up. I need to ask you something.
What? She muttered, still mostly asleep. What is it? Are you okay?
Morgan, would you do something for me if I asked you to?
Sure, Morgan said. What? Then her eyes opened wide and she focused, the scream caught in her throat becoming a sharp gasp instead. Finn was sweating blood, literally. It covered him like a delicate dark red mist, a ruby dew that made his skin shimmer when he moved. He wasn't bleeding, exactly. Instead, the blood was a fine, thin, glowing, roseate spray that was becoming more opaque by the second.
Finn, oh my God, what's happening to you?
It doesn't hurt, Morgan. I promise it doesn't. Not yet.
Finn, what's happening to you?
Morgan, do you love me?
Yes, yes, I love you. Now tell me what's happening.
I need you to help me, Morgan, Finn said, his voice breaking. I can't do this by myself. You have to help me. Please? He looked towards the window where the sky was now bright enough for her to see everything in the room, then back at Morgan with pleading eyes. Do you understand? Morgan started to cry.
No, Finn, please, I can't, she sobbed. Don't ask me to do that. I can't. Stay with me. We'll figure something out, I promise. Please, Finn, please, I just can't.
Listen to me, Finn said gently. I want to find Sadie. I want to be with my dog again. I miss her. I want to be somewhere else. I want to be in the place I was in before all this happened. I want to go home. A lot of bad things happen in Parr's Landing, but it isn't all bad. Nothing is all bad. I was happy. I had my mom and my dad. I had my school and my comics. And I had Sadie. I want to hug her. I want to go for a walk with her again up on Spirit Rock. This morning. Now. But I can't do it by myself. My body won't let me. What do I have to do? Morgan thought she had never seen a more loving or radiant smile in her life. Finn pointed to the door. Just walk with me out there, out into the sunlight where Sadie is. And if I can't do it, push me. Mutely, she nodded, white-faced. When they reached the door, Finn turned to her and hugged her. I love you, Morgan, he whispered.
Thank you.
Then Morgan opened the front door and walked Finn into the dawn. In the end, dying a second time proved different than anything Finn had ever imagined it might be. For one thing, the pain that his small, shrieking body felt as the sunlight ignited a holocaust under his skin, an incandescence that boiled his blood and set alight his bones from the inside, charring them to ash in seconds, was surprisingly brief, even momentary. Such, it seemed, was the nature of the soul. Even a soul like Finn's, that had been severed from its natural life and forced into rebirth into an unnatural one. Rising above his body as it writhed and burned on the ground, Finn saw, not without pain and shame, that Morgan was screaming as well. He'd hurt her after all, the one person whom he wanted most to spare any pain. the bare skin of her arms, where she'd held him as he tried to duck back inside the house at the moment the sunlight first struck his undead flesh, exactly as he'd begged her to do, was scorched and seared and blistered from the fire. His fire. Because there were no more secrets. Because every truth of the world, past, present, and future, was laid bare to the dead, the true dead, as Finn now was. He knew that Morgan would bear livid scars on her arms for the rest of her life. They would fade a bit more every year, but he knew, as the dead know, that Morgan would think of him every day when she looked at them, and the thoughts would be tender ones, thoughts of love and sadness. The horror would eventually become a half-remembered nightmare, and he was glad for that. He knew she would never return to Parr's Landing, nor would her mother, and that neither of them would ever see Billy Lightning again. Finn continued to rise. The dead of Parr's Landing surged around him like transcendental tributaries to a larger sea of souls, and time itself spun like a great tumbler of history and memory. The dead opened their arms to Finn in love, pulled him close, carried him higher and higher. His soul wept for the half-souls that remained trapped. As Finn was absorbed into the massive vortex of spiraling black light, he looked down one last time. Below him, he saw the oak doors of St. Bartholomew and the Martyrs crash open. Christina Parr, screaming her daughter's name, ran with the speed only the mother of an injured child ever really attains to the place where Morgan knelt, weeping over the charred skeleton of the 12-year-old boy Finn once was. Finn saw Christina tenderly wrap her daughter in blankets and carefully carry her to Billy Lightning's truck, depositing her gently in the passenger seat and starting it up. The dead see all roads, spiritual and temporal alike, and Finn was well pleased with what he saw ahead on theirs. And then, the part of Finn Miller that was eternal heard the sound of a red rubber ball striking his bedroom floor. His soul was suddenly engulfed in familiar fragrance, clover and lake water and sunlight on soft black fur, and he was awash in frantic movement, warmth, and love. The sound of Finn's laughter fell like blue sparks, and the sound of Sadie's triumphant, joyous barking fell like black ones, and together their essences became one with the souls around them, passing completely from the world of the living into a perfect, brilliant sunrise above Bradley Lake and the cliffs of Spirit Rock. There was no pain in it this time, only sunlight that no longer burned. End. Parr's Landing Police Department, 75 Main Street East, Parr's Landing, Ontario, P2T1R2, 807-731-1002, 2, Sergeant Gil Stiles, Giles Point Police Department, Giles Point, Ontario. From Sergeant Dave Thompson, Parr's Landing, October 25, 1972. Dear Gil, following up on our telephone conversation of earlier this evening, a local boy, Finn Miller, found this hockey bag and its contents in the Spirit Rock area while looking for his dog. PC Elliot McKittrick came upon the young man over the course of doing rounds and brought the boy and the hockey bag back to the station where we took it into evidence. The bag appears to contain archaeological tools. In light of the Carstairs' disappearance on the night of October 22nd in Giles Point, I recommend that you forward them to Bruce Benson at the RCMP in Sault Ste. Marie for forensic lab analysis of fingerprints and blood type. Also found in the bag were several documents that have been identified by Dr. William Lightning, a visitor to Parr's Landing, as having belonged to his father, Dr. Phineas Osborne of Toronto, who was the victim of homicide early this year. Dr. Lightning believes they were taken from his father's house during the course of said homicide. As an aside, he believes the perpetrator was Richard Wheel, a former student of Dr. Osborne's, but according to the information we have from Metro Toronto Homicide, Wheel is deceased. We do not consider Dr. Lightning a suspect at this time, though we have asked him to remain in Parr's Landing for the next few days. Please call if we can be of any further help. Dave Thompson, Sergeant, Parr's Landing. From the notes of Professor Phineas Osborne, Department of Anthropology, University of Toronto, Sydney Smith Hall, 100 St. George Street, Toronto, Fall Term, 1971. Note. The text that follows is my translation of an original document held by Professor Victor Kleinschmidt of the Department of History at the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor. The document itself, written in French, dates from the 17th century and appears to be a letter from a Jesuit missionary on his deathbed, addressed to his superiors in Rome. I have cross-referenced both this document with every available edition of the Jesuit Relations, but have found no reference to it, nor to the priest mentioned, Father Nyon, in any available record pertaining to the history of the Jesuits in Canada. Dr. Kleinschmidt, upon hearing of my work on the St. Barthélemy dig in Parr's Landing in the summer of 1952, invited me to come to Michigan to read it and to translate, which I did. It is worth noting that I did not share any of the specific events surrounding the excavation of the St. Barthélemy site during the summer of 1952 with Dr. Kleinschmidt, so his delivery of this document into my hands was in no way intended to support any fantastical notions of what might have occurred there that summer. The story, as read here, presents a plausible theory of the origin of the Wendigo legend of St. Barthélemy by a writer obviously familiar with myths and legends of that period. In 1968, I forwarded a copy of my translation to Father Pedro Arupe, S.J., the 28th and current Superior General of the Society of Jesus in Rome, to inquire as to why it had not been included among the official records of the Jesuit missions to New France. On February 12th, I received a brief, very courteous reply, see later notes attached, from the Superior General's secretary thanking me for my letter, assuring me that the Reverend Father had enjoyed reading the document I sent him, and thanking me for my, quote, assiduous scholarship, end quote, and my, quote, interest in the glorious history of the Jesuit martyrs, end quote. But asserting that, owing to both its, quote, fantastical and lurid, end quote, subject matter as well as its length, the document was clearly a forgery, though it had already been examined on both paleographic and material grounds by Professor Kleinschmidt, and found to be consistent, even if the subject matter itself was not. It's not surprising to me that the SG would find this embarrassing if fictional, and mortifying if it was proven to be an authentic record of the delusions of a Jesuit missionary, likely driven mad by the isolation of Northern Ontario in the 17th century. The Jesuit motto, Ad Majorem Dei Gloriam, to the greater glory of God, is repeated several times in this narrative, which struck me as unusual, since one can infer that both the writer and the recipient were already well familiar with its meaning. There is an earnestness to its use here that seems noteworthy, especially in the context of the narrative, as becomes obvious. N.B. Must forward a copy to Billy. He will find this entertaining, especially in light of our adventures with good Dick Wheel of that summer. P.K.O. Ph.D. 9-12-71. being the last true testament and relation of Father Alphonse Nyon, given at Montreal, Quebec, in the form of a letter, to the very Reverend Father Vincenzo Carafa, Superior General of the Society of Jesus at Rome, Anno Domini, 1650. Very Reverend Father in Christ, Pax Christi. I send this last relation in the hopes that it will reach your reverence by the ship returning to France before the ice in this bitter region renders entirely compromised the passage of our vessels across the ocean. I fear that my time here in this land is short, as the pox that has plagued hundreds of the savages, thankfully a goodly number of them baptized, and brought to our Christian faith, and now resting in the arms of our Lord Jesus Christ in heaven, has taken me into its embrace as well. I write with difficulty, and have entrusted the care and delivery of this relation to your reverence into the hands of my friend Father Charles Vimont. He has sworn to seal this document, and not to cast his eyes upon its contents, which are for the eyes of your reverence alone, on the peril of his immortal soul. For my part, my vain prayers that I should again see the shores of my homeland, or the beautiful cathedral of Notre Dame de Chartres, where I first heard our Lord's call as a young man, or indeed once again touch the face of my beloved mother, have been denied by our Lord, and I submit myself joyfully to his will. My one true regret during these many years of service to the savages of New France is that I should have been spared the great honor of martyrdom, the great blessing enjoined upon so many of our fallen fathers at the bloody hands of the Iroquois. Most lately, Father de Brébeuf, Father Chabanel, and Father de Lalande, who died so horribly at St. Marie among the Hurons last year, praising the name of Christ and giving absolution to their barbarian tormentors with their last breath, even after their tongues were cut out, for they kept preaching till death released them. I pray for your reverence's understanding, prayers, and meditation upon the reading of this, my last relation and testament. For it is with a heavy heart that I set down the strange and terrible events I witnessed at St. Barthélemy among the Ojibwa in the northern Lac Superieur region of the country in winter of the year of our Lord, 1632. These secrets I have kept to myself for nearly 20 years, confiding them not even in the sacrament of confession, though I regularly opened my heart to God and begged his forgiveness, not only for the blasphemies I have seen, but also for those I have wrought myself in my sad and pitiable effort to do his will as best as could be done by one so unworthy. In the autumn of that dark year of which I write, word was received by Monsieur de Champlain at Trois-Rivières of the destruction of two of our settlements near Sault de Gaston, in Huronia, and the martyrdom of three of our Jesuit fathers in what could only have been an attack by the Iroquois, for their fiendish handiwork leaves a spore as unmistakable as the handiwork of Satan himself. In the first, the mission of St. Berthe, the martyrs were, by name, Father Renaud d'Olivier, Father Matthew Glazier, and Father Nausson d'Ange. The fathers had traveled from France together and, it was reported, had been as close as brothers. I pray they found comfort in their brotherhood at the end. The Indian trappers reported the hideous sight of the maimed and tortured bodies of d'Olivier, Glazier, and d'Ange. Their scorched bodies still hung from the stakes to which they were tied and left for carrion. The savages, it was reported, had poured boiling water over their heads in mockery of baptism and cut out their eyes and tongues, placing live coals in the sockets. Likewise, they reported the smoke still heavy and foul over the burned village, and many dead, including a number of baptized savages. We wept at this news, even though we knew that our fallen brothers had attained the heights of heaven, having died in the greatest possible service to our Lord Jesus Christ. Never have the words of our Jesuit motto, Ad majorem de gloriam, comforted me more than they did in the hours that followed the news of the Father's martyrdom. In the second instance, the strange news was of the mission of St. Barthélemy, deep in the Ojibwa region of that country, a region noted for the cruelty of the terrain itself and of the strangeness of its customs, superstitions, and legends. So tight, it is said, is the devil's hold upon these poor people that establishing a mission in this particular region had long been an ambition of the Crown in its support of our work here in New France. In the case of the mission of St. Barthélemy, the trappers related that the mission seemed entirely abandoned. Unlike the mission of St. Berthe, which had clearly fallen to an attack by the Iroquois, the mission at St. Barthélemy appeared deserted as though the inhabitants, both Christian and savage, had all departed freely and of their own volition. The trappers observed this and more, and related it to Monsieur de Champlain, who in turn related it to Father de Varennes, who was then the representative responsible for dispatching our fathers on their missions upriver in the company of their Huron guides. It was at this point that I was summoned to meet with Father de Varennes at Trois-Rivières. I was then still a very young man, all of 21, a year in New France since my departure from Chartres, and foolish in the fearless way of all young men, but determined to serve the will of God with all of my body and soul. I knew even then that martyrdom for the greater glory of God would be the highest attainment, and yet my poor flesh dreaded it, dreaded the agony of the flames of the stake as it dreaded the butchery of blade and spear. I confess that fear with shame, but with the open-hearted humility that my own unworthiness demands. Father de Varennes wasted no time in asking me what I knew of the settlement of St. Barthélemy. Sadly, I told him, I had only heard of it in passing through the stories of the other young priests. I knew little of the region or of the mission itself. Do you, for instance, de Varennes asked me, know anything of the Ojibwa people, Father Nyon? Do you know their language and customs? I have studied their language, Father, I replied. I am not fluent, but I have tried to prepare myself as best I could in the event that my service in New France led me there. You know by now, Father Nyon, of the recent destruction of our mission at St. Berthe, and the slaughter of our priests at the hand of the Iroquois? I nodded, bowing my head, yes, Father, a great tragedy. Have you then also heard, he asked, of the mystery of our settlement of St. Barthélemy, near the shore of Lac Supérieur, which has been reported as entirely deserted? Yes, Father, but again, only in passing, only in the form of rumor and conjecture. Stories from around the campfire in these last weeks. The gossip of trappers. The old priest smiled at that, but again he grew serious. Father Nyon, he said, we have dispatched one of our priests, Father Luberon, in the company of a party of Algonquins, to recover the bodies of our fallen fathers at St. Berthe and to give them a Christian burial. It is a gruesome assignation, but Father Luberon has volunteered. We can only pray for his safe return and that he does not meet the same fate that befell d'Olivier, Glazier, and Duonge. I too will pray for that, Father, I told him. I would also have volunteered if I had known of the assignation. Father de Varennes looked hard at me and said, Is that what is truly in your heart, Father Nyon? I replied that it was indeed. Father Nyan, I would like you to travel north to the region of Saint de Gaston and visit the site of the Saint Barthélemy settlement and see if what the trappers reported is true. I would like you to find the priest, Father de Seligny. If the savages murdered him, I would like you to bury him and perform the last rites. If he is alive, I would like you to bring him back with you to Trois-Rivières so he may give his own account of what transpired at the mission. I accept joyfully, Father, I said, quite proud of myself for having been put in charge of such an undertaking. What can you tell me of Father de Seligny, Father? I have not heard that name before. Has he been long in New France? Father de Seligny arrived in New France in 1625 as one of the priests who answered the appeal of the Recollect friars in order to aid them in their work with the Indian missions, Father de Varennes explained. The Recollets were insufficient in numbers to successfully cope with the nature and hardships of evangelizing the savages. But what of the man, I persisted, who is he? The man? Father de Varennes laughed. Ah, yes, the man. I know only the priest, but you ask me about the man. Let us see. Father de Seligny is descended from a noble family in the Nord-Pas-de-Calais, the most northerly region of France. He is kinsman to the Vicomte de Morièvre of that region. He took his vows in Paris, at Montmartre, and as I said, he came to us here in New France in 1625. By reports, it was a long and terrible voyage from Dieppe to Quebec. An unknown wasting sickness descended on crew and passengers alike. Many shriveled and died, including some priests. Father de Seligny survived. He was dispatched to the Ojibwa that very year. He is a learned man. As I recall, he was also grave in manner and demeanor. In truth, I don't remember much of the man, and even now it is the priest I am concerned with, not the man. Forgive my impertinence, Father, I said humbly, but if he wasn't murdered by the savages, might there have been another reason for his abandonment of his mission? Father de Varennes sighed at that. Sadly, I believe we must prepare ourselves for the worst, Father Nyan. With courage I did not feel, I told Father de Varennes that I would do my duty and meet my fate joyfully, whatever it might be. Your journey will take you approximately 5 weeks, Father de Varennes said. It will be an exceptionally difficult one and fraught with hardship. You speak the Algonquin language, I'm told. Not well, Father, but I can understand the language better than I can speak it. The Algonquins accompanying you will take you to the region of Saint de Gaston and will deliver you safely to the mission of Saint Barthélemy. They camp nearby and will wait to bring you back, either alone or with Father de Seligny. Do you have any questions, Father? No, Father, I said. I understand everything. When will I be leaving? Father de Varennes hesitated as though considering my youth. Then he drew himself up to his full height and said, not unkindly, At dawn, Father Nyan, and may God be with you. At that we knelt together and prayed for some time in the chapel. Father de Varennes introduced me to my stoical Algonquin guide, Oscueto. He bade me spend the remainder of the afternoon in prayer and meditation, and then retire early for my departure from Trois-Rivières. After the departure of Father de Varennes, I walked a bit about the post and then took myself down to the river, feeling the need to see it once, alone, before my departure at the dawn on the morrow. As I approached the edge of the dark water, I noticed a man following me at a cautious distance. He was clearly French, one of those hommes du Nord, or hivernants, as the voyagers who transport furs by canoe and overwinter in the regions beyond Montreal and Grand Portage are often called. Like so many of them, a crude and filthy-looking man who, through long exposure to the savages and carnal knowledges of the vilest sort with savage women, had begun to resemble the Indians more than he resembled a white man. By coincidence, I did know this man's name. He was called Dumont, and was known to be of low moral character, over-fond of spirits, a dishonest dealer with the savages, and an unrepentant consort of their women. I paused by the water and waited, my intention being to ask him what he wanted. I had no fear of him, for what Frenchman here in Trois-Rivières would harm a priest? But he spoke first, and most strangely. He asked me, "You are the priest who will be going to St. Bartholomew with the Algonquins?" I told him yes, and I asked him what business it was of his. He laughed and showed me a reeking mouthful of rotten teeth. The stench issuing from his open mouth was a horror in its own right. "Do you know what awaits you at St. Bartholomew? Do you know what is there? I expect to recover the body of Father de Seligny of that mission," I said, "though my heartiest prayers are that I will find him alive and well and safely in the service of our Lord." At that, Dumont laughed again. But it was not a laugh of joy or even one of malice. It was a forced laugh, one in which I thought I detected a trace of something akin to fear. And yet this man Dumont had already openly lived a rough and vile life. I could not fathom what could have made him afraid of speaking openly about the mission. "What do you know of the mission at St. Bartholomew?" I asked him, with a boldness I did not feel. "What do you know of the fate of Father de Seligny? If you have something to share, share it now, or keep your peace." He shrugged again. "I know nothing," said he. "I speak of nothing." "Not true, Dumont," I replied. "Tomorrow I am leaving for St. Bartholomew. If there is something you know or have heard, I charge you to tell me, and indeed, to tell me now and in all haste." At that, Dumont leaned close to me and said, "The Indians of Lac Supérieur, they fear him." "Who?" I demanded. "Father de Seligny?" "Yes, him." Dumont crossed himself. The reverent gesture, so earnestly performed, seemed so incongruous in that setting, and from that man, that I fear I laughed. "Of course they fear him," I scoffed. "The Indians blame us for everything. These countries and these poor ignorant people are in Lucifer's thrall. They blame us when there is an outbreak of the pox. They blame us when there is a famine. They blame us when there is a drought. They call the rite of baptism water sorcery. They accuse us of performing witchcraft in our chapels. They call us demons in black robes." "No," Dumont whispered. "They fear de Seligny himself." He looked all around as though to make sure no one was listening. "They call him Ouitigo, an eater of human flesh and a drinker of blood. Human in form, but Miji Mannidu, a demon." "The savages do not understand the rite of communion," I explained as patiently as I could, trying not to show my irritation. "They confuse it with their own barbarism or the barbarism of the Iroquois." "No," Dumont insisted. "It is more than that. The savages of which I speak have no quarrel with the black robes. But they give the mission of St. Bartholomew in Sault de Gaston a wide berth." "Then perhaps those are the savages who have killed Father de Seligny," I said in outrage. "If you have information about his fate, Dumont, you will come with me now to Father de Varenne, and you will tell him what you know, or what you have heard from the savages. I know nothing, Dumont said. I have heard nothing. And I will tell Father de Varenne nothing. If you know nothing, my son, then what is your purpose here? Why did you seek me out today? I asked him in bafflement. Do you have something to confess? Do you not wish to be granted absolution? I can absolve you, but before I do, you must confess to me. Dumont again grew pale. Again he crossed himself. This time I did not laugh, for a mask of such dread and tragedy contorted his face that Melpomene herself would have recoiled from it. He seemed suddenly in the throes of a deep and profound spiritual terror. Were he not so clearly a man of a dissolute and profane reputation, I would have even said that he feared that his very soul was in peril from something he had done, or seen. So awful was Dumont's expression that I had but one thought, that he had himself witnessed the awful martyrdom of Father de Seligny at the hands of the savages, and that it had been a most fearsome and terrible death. In his eyes I found every nightmare that had tormented me, as a young priest in Chartres, about the terrible and agonizing fate that might await me here in New France. I need no absolution, Father, Dumont said. But perhaps God will grant you the strength and knowledge to conquer what awaits you in St. Barthélemy. We have brought terrible things to New France. There are worse things now walking in the forests at night than the savages. He knelt and took my crucifix in his filthy hands and kissed it. I will pray for you, Father. Pray for me also. With that, Dumont rose to his feet. He looked around him and then quickly took his leave from my company by a trail that I knew led to the other side of the post, where some of the Hivernants kept their canoes. He did not turn or look back as he hurried along his way before disappearing from view behind the trees. The cold I felt in the wake of Dumont's leave-taking was due only in part to the sinking of the sun in the sky or the freezing egress of the coming night. I looked all around me and saw anew the cruel beauty of this wild country of white rivers and black lakes and forests. I saw afresh the savagery here, in nature as in man. Truly, I thought, this is the devil's own dominion. Even poor, mad Dumont, in all of his fear and confusion, knew it. There are worse things now walking in the forests at night than the savages, Father, he'd said. I realized again that we, soldiers of God, were little more than pinpricks of his light in the vast darkness of this terrible place, and the only beacons by which the Indians might be guided, with Christ's help, away from Satan and into God's glorious light. I puzzled over his statement that we, meaning the French, had brought those things here. For surely the light we brought with us has not been only the light of God, but also the light of civilization and knowledge. But ultimately I ascribed the words to his confusion. Perhaps ultimately Dumont, after so many godless years among them, had become savage himself. I swore to pray for him. And pray I did that night, though not only for Dumont or Father de Seligny. Sleep was reluctant to claim me, but eventually it did. It seemed I had barely closed my eyes before Ascoueto was shaking me awake with the utmost force and impatience to begin the journey upriver to the mission of St. Barthélemy among the Ojibwa in Sault de Gaston. We departed in two canoes into a dark gray dawn wreathed in heavy fog and a lowering sky threatening rain. The rains of that first autumn of mine in Trois-Rivières were unlike any I had known as a boy coming to maturity in Beauce. It was of a particular piercing cold, as though the angels themselves were hurling frozen nails from a celestial height to pierce and humble the proud and unaccustomed. The rivers here also bore no resemblance to any of the three branches of the gentle Eure near my family's home near Chartres. Instead, they were wild and serpentine, wending through the rocks and the forests, too, it seemed, to the very edge of the world. The Indians are impermeable to hardship in a way that we Europeans cannot fathom. I had, of course, been made aware of the stoical inurement particular to these people before I left France, but hearing it described by returning priests was entirely different to seeing it in the flesh. The savage women, too, paddle the canoes alongside their men, as well as carry their own heavy packs along the trails. Their hands are hard and calloused, and would be unrecognizable in France as belonging to any but the hardest working peasant. I sat close behind Askewato in the canoe and tried to match the force of his paddle stroke. He bent his body to the task, as though it were a Sisyphean machine, his back leaning into each stroke. Each time his paddle cut the black water, a perfect white-crested whirlpool spun away in its wake. Try as I might to imitate his movements, my own poor attempts were clumsy and ineffectual. In truth, I felt unmanned, and yet I set myself arduously to my own portion of the labor, remembering well the admonitions of Father de Varenne with regard to the savage's measure of me. My life depended in no small part on their protection and goodwill. Indeed, my position relative to theirs became more and more obvious. While I might be their intellectual and spiritual superior through the agency of my education and my role as Christ's humble representative in their world of godless ignorance, they were, in every practical sense, my superiors. I saw and felt this reality with every stroke of the paddle that took me farther and farther into the wilderness. We camped that first night by the shore of a nameless lake, nameless to me, though I do not doubt the savages had a name for it, as they have a name for everything in earthly nature, as well as names for their pantheon of pagan gods and spirits that, I had been told, dwelt not only in the heavens above, but shared the earth with them. My hands were raw and bleeding from the repetitive friction of wet skin against wood after that first long day's paddle. Sitting about the campfire that night with the Indians, one of the older women, Hossis, noticed my pain. From one of her packs, she withdrew a greasy poultice. She started to apply it to my wounds. When I pulled back and uttered some instinctive protest, she grasped my wrist as firmly as if I were an unruly child and rebuked me in Algonquin. Then she applied the poultice even more vigorously upon my wounds. In truth, the sting in my hands from the paddle began almost immediately to subside, a cooling sensation spreading across my palms, and indeed everywhere the poultice touched my skin. "Miigwech," I said in awe, thanking Hossis in my own crude Algonquin. I looked down at my hands in wonderment, for the pain had almost completely vanished as though it had never been there. She spoke again in Algonquin, calling me stupid or foolish, but in no way unkindly. She smiled and put the poultice back inside her buckskin pack, then shuffled off to join her putative husband by the fire. The Indians regarded me with amusement as I continued to stare at my hands. but then made room for me when I went myself to sit closer to the flames, I found the smell of them comforting. That curious mixture of buckskin, sweat, dried lake water, and smoke from the fire. In truth, their very presence was a bulwark against the terrors of the unknown and the unknowable. The darkness surrounding the fire was of an opacity the likes of which I had never known in France. Or perhaps it seemed darker because, in France, I knew reasonably well what it might conceal. Here, in this savage devil's land, God only knew what lay beneath night's cloak, hidden and in wait. As we lay down and prepared to sleep, I looked about me uneasily, for, unbidden, Dumont's words had come back to me. There are worse things now walking in the forests at night than the savages. I said a prayer for our safety and put myself in God's hands as we slept. This time I slept soundly and without dreams, surrounded by my Indian protectors. The next morning upon waking, I washed in the lake before my morning prayers. The poultice on my hands that had dried and crusted while I slept was rinsed off in the lake water. Miraculously, my hands had almost completely healed while I was asleep. Examining them in the pink light of the early dawn, I saw that the wounds were dry and had already scabbed. I went to find Hossis, the old woman who had acted as my surgeon, to show her this miracle. But when I did, she seemed uninterested. Hossis looked away, muttering words under her breath in Algonquin I could not understand. After taking our morning meal, we packed up our rudimentary camp, loaded the two canoes, and again we set out across the water in the direction of Sault de Gaston. The first few weeks passed without incident. They evolved into a back-breaking cycle of repetitive days that began at dawn and ended at sunset. The air had grown decidedly colder as the days shortened in anticipation of the coming winter. The hills and mountains surrounding the lakes and rivers were dappled in scarlet and saffron yellow, breathtakingly beautiful in the wildness of their color. One morning, we woke to a light dusting of snow around the camp, but it melted with the sun almost before we were underway again. The men shot wild fowl that the women would then prepare as part of our supper, and they fished the dark water with a dexterity at which I marveled. Though the work of paddling and camping became no easier, and in fact, the land grew more rugged and forbidding the closer we came to our destination, making the portaging of the canoes and packs more difficult, a camaraderie of sorts seemed to have grown between us. I am under no illusion that the Indians saw me as one of them, and indeed they often mocked my seeming inability to master the most rudimentary of their skills, from paddling to portaging, yet we had settled into a peaceable accord. My proficiency with the bow and arrow, however, surprised them, especially the men. Unbeknownst to them, of course, my father had hunted often on our family's estate in Beauce, and he had drilled me throughout my boyhood in this one martial skill. Ascueto, in particular, took delight in my ability to shoot. On such occasions as we had time for recreation, which were precious few, he allowed me to practice with his own bow and arrow. While Ascueto was my unchallenged superior, I flatter myself that I won a measure of his respect, in time. I spoke my crude Algonquin with the other paddlers. With Ascueto, I spoke a mixture of Algonquin and French, by which we both seemed to understand one another. We were not friends. The very idea seemed preposterous, especially then. But perhaps my utter dependence on him, coupled with my willingness to share a full portion of the work of our voyage and matched the Indians effort for effort, had roused an answering kindness in him that made him more than merely my guide. I came to find comfort in the sound of their voices, especially at night in the forest around the campfire. The sound had become a sort of lodestar of safety in the midst of the wilderness. Blessedly, there had been no sign of Iroquois hunters along our route. In itself, a miracle, for their appearance would have very likely signaled our doom. I realized that the Algonquins had been paid to protect me, and, as much as I might doubt their commitment to my safety, still I sensed that this group wished me no ill will, and indeed would safeguard me to the best of their ability, and deliver me to the site of St. Bartholomew as promised, and wait there to return me to Trois-Rivières, either tragically alone or in the company of Father de Sélagny. In the fourth week of our journey, we stopped in an Ojibwa village, a week's paddle or more from Sault de Gaston. It was apparently a village where Oscoueto was known and respected, for the chief received him. The chief and some of the savages took my measure gravely, and with what appeared to be suspicion. Oscoueto turned his back to me and spoke to them in a low voice. Over his shoulder, the chief and the men with him continued to regard me with something I took to be either anger or fear, or indeed some mixture of both. Anger I had seen before during my year in New France, but their fear was something with which I was unfamiliar. Clearly, at Trois-Rivières, the Indians were used to us, and even farther afield than the settlement there, we fathers were more likely to be met with contempt than fear. And yet, there it was in the eyes of the chief and his men. Fear, or so it appeared to me. Finally, Oscoueto turned to me and spoke in French. "Black Robe," he said, "the chief wants to speak with me alone. Go through the village to the water's edge and wait for me." I answered him in Algonquin, asking him what was wrong. I had a notion that the chief might more kindly consider me if I spoke one of their languages. Again, Oscoueto spoke to me in French. "Go, Black Robe," he said gruffly. "Go wait by the water. Do not answer me in Algonquin. Do not speak my name. Do not answer me at all. Go now." Without a word, I turned and walked towards the village, which was not itself dissimilar to others I had seen. Huts of birch pole and tents, the whole place a seething, untidy coil of savages, their filthy children and their verminous dogs, all intermingling hither and thither in the mud or squatting on their haunches, men and women both, in apparently earnest debate or parley. The acrid smoke from the wood-cooking fires and the odor of the savages themselves, combined with the noise of their squalling children and barking dogs, became almost overpowering. I was more eager than not to obey Oscoueto, and so I went to the edge of the lake and waited for him there. After a time, Oscoueto came to where I was sitting. I had not heard him approach until he was standing behind me. I turned and looked up. The sun was behind him, so his face was hidden from my sight. "Black Robe," he said, "we may stay here tonight, but only tonight. And we are told we must stand guard over you until the dawn. Also, you may not sleep in the village. You must sleep here, near the water, away from the people." "Why?" I queried, rousing myself to a standing position. "For what reasons?" "They fear you," Oscoueto replied. He stared at me with no expression. It was as though the fact of the Indians fearing me was so entirely reasonable that it required no elucidation. "What is there to fear?" I scoffed. They know of us. They have seen black robes before. Surely we have more to fear from them than they have to fear from us. They have seen black robes before, Askewato said, with that maddening, implacable stolidity of the savages. They are not afraid of black robes. They are afraid of you. Of me? Why? They believe you are Weetigo. They believe you are like the other black robe, the one you go to. Askewetu was silent for a long moment, then he spoke again. You will sleep here, black robe. I will guard you. I am not afraid of you. I do not believe you are a Weetigo. If you go to the village tonight, they will kill you. And tomorrow we leave. Why do they believe this? I was again outraged. This is nonsense. It is blasphemy. They speak of the other black robe. They say he eats flesh. They say he drinks blood. Askewetu, I said, trying to calm myself. I spoke slowly, enunciating carefully, in French, which Askewetu rudimentarily understood. We have told you the meaning of the Eucharist. You know of the rituals of the black robes, how the bread and the wine become the body and blood of Jesus Christ through the miracle of transubstantiation. We do not eat the flesh of human beings, nor do we drink their blood. The very thought is an affront to God. The people of this village do not understand. You should have explained it to them better. You speak their language. Tell them they are mistaken. Weetigo eats the body and drinks the blood, he insisted stubbornly. He gestured to the village behind him. There are many stories of Weetigo here. People have seen the Weetigo in the village where we go to your black robe. There are many dead. He gestured again, this time towards the lake. Many dead in the water. They fell from the sky. He gestured overhead. This Weetigo flies at night like the owl. He runs like the wolf. He has killed many. I was frustrated by Askewetu's dogged insistence that this gruesome Indian legend of a mythical demon, as I then understood it, an evil spirit that enters a human body and possesses it, turning the unlucky vessel into a cannibal monster, was true. I was horrified that it should be so blasphemously entangled with our own holy ritual of communion. I was reminded again of Dumont's disquieting raving on the shore at Trois-Rivières about Father de Seligny being something other than human. While it had been relatively easy to dismiss Dumont as mad, it was harder to be as sanguine in the face of Askewetu's declaration that he was all that was standing between me and a terrible death at the hands of an entire village of Ojibwa savages who believed I was in league with a living demon. Worse still was the ever more likely possibility that Father de Seligny had been murdered by a group of terrified savages who believed they were ridding their village of a monster. I opened my mouth to protest again, but Askewetu silenced me with a sharp gesture. Be quiet, Black Robe, he said. You stay here. I will guard you. We leave in the morning when sun rises. That night in the moonlight, at several separate intervals, I was aware of the sly sound of moccasin-shod feet on dirt and stone as the Indians came to stare at me whilst I lay under my blanket, feigning sleep and listening to the sound of my heart in my chest. Their gruesome legends, their tales of flesh-devouring, blood-drinking demons and the spirits that walked their forest at night, were easier to dismiss in the daylight. But when, like at that moment, the dull moon was the only light able to pierce this infernal darkness at the edge of the world, the borders between our world of the living and their land of the dead seemed to shimmer and grow indistinct. The Indians did not come too near. From their soft, fretful whispering, I came to believe that they were not keeping their distance simply because I was under the protection of Oscoweto, but also because the Indians were afraid of me. That morning, I again woke, shivering, to a light covering of snow upon the ground. The dark green trees were likewise wreathed and crested with white, and stood out starkly against the deadened sky. The sun remained hidden behind lead-colored clouds that seemed an advance guard of the deadly coming winter. As I prayed that morning, I entreated God that we might find Father de Seligny alive and well, presiding over his Christianized congregation at St. Barthélemy, and that I might either return with him to Trois-Rivières or winter with him in Sault-de-Gaston if the route back became impassable because of the killing cold. We again loaded the canoes in preparation for our departure. Oscoweto and his paddlers were solemn that morning, entirely different in their demeanor than they had been every morning during the last month of our voyage inland. They whispered amongst themselves, and, though I may have been imagining it, I caught them looking at me when they thought me unawares, glancing away quickly when I returned their gaze. At one point, a near brawl appeared to break out between Oscoweto and Chogan, one of the younger men in our party of paddlers, who had been glaring at me all through the morning. Oscoweto struck him about the shoulders and rebuked him in Algonquin, though I was too far away to understand his words. When Chogan pointed at me, Oscoweto seized the younger man's arm and forced it down to his side. Oscoweto addressed him sharply but in a low voice, and Chogan looked vindictively in my direction one more time, then dropped his eyes in submission to Oscoweto, my protector. Of course, I had seen the entire exchange, but still I pretended that I had not, as much for my own security as for Shogun's pride. As we launched into the water, I saw that the entire village had arrayed itself on the shore, as though to assure themselves that we had indeed departed from their midst. They stared solemnly in our wake as the canoes glided into the morning fog, not speaking nor shouting, but entirely, raptly following the trajectory of our canoes with their eyes. So general was the ghostly silence that when one of the paddles rapped against the side of the boat, I cried out in shock. The Indians kept their heads down and paddled, showing no reaction to my outcry. No laughter this time, and none of the usual well-meant mockery. Instead, we paddled in silence until the mist enveloped us and the land behind us vanished from sight. After 5 hard, uncomfortable days of mostly silent paddling, we made a gruesome discovery in the early evening of the 5th day as we crossed a particularly vast lake. Lulled and hypnotized by the repetitive motion of the paddle, I was suddenly jolted to consciousness by a sharp shout of warning from the bowsman of the other canoe. I raised my head and squinted to see where he was pointing. There, floating face down on the surface of the black water, was the body of a girl perhaps no more than 12 or 13. I crossed myself and stifled my despair at the tragic sight. The girl's body must have floated on some sort of very strong underwater current, for we seemed several miles from either shore, and there seemed no other earthly way for it to have found itself so far from land. The fantastical thought came to me that she had been dropped from the air, as though from the talons of some monstrous bird in mid-flight. Too, there seemed to be no putrescence or other decay. She looked as though she had fallen asleep in the lake that very afternoon and simply drifted away on the waves. "Pull her to us," I implored them. Let us take her to shore so that I may say a prayer for her and we can bury her. The Indians naturally ignored me. But there had been no need for my exhortations in any case. The men were already carefully reaching for her, using their paddles almost as grappling hooks, pulling the girl's body towards them. The combination of their paddles and the motion of the waves that had sprung up in the breeze caused the body to roll in the water. As it did, the full abomination of the tableau revealed itself to all of us, and I again had occasion to cross myself. The girl's eyes had not rolled up in her head. Rather, they seemed to stare fixedly at us. The pupils were dilated so that they looked like two pieces of flat black glass. But oh, the mute asseverations of dread in those eyes! The terror frozen eternally in violent death. Her mouth was stretched open in a silent scream of pain and terror. Worst of all, her throat had been all but torn out, as though by the jaws of a wolf, the flesh of the wound washed clean and pink by the lake water. Her poor fingers were fixed into claws, as though in her last moments she had been fighting to escape from whatever beast killed her. The effect on the Indians was marvelous. With a collective cry of despair, they pushed the body away from them. They beat the water to a white froth with their paddles as they turned the canoes about, gaining distance between themselves and the poor dead girl's body in a trice. "Stop, stop," I screamed. "Go back, we must bury her." But stop the Indians did not. They laid their backs into their paddling, as though the spot was accursed. The lost child's body floating in that desolate lake shrank to a distant speck, a lonely sacrilege bobbing in the black waves as the sun sank behind the hills and the night came alive around us. The next morning, Askewetto avowed to me that we were very near our destination. He said we would reach St. Bartholomew that night, and that we would portage inland from Lac Superieur, then camp in the forest near a small lake which, he told me, was hidden within a rocky region known to be treacherous. It may have been the combined effect of the dramatic hibernal shift in the weather and the changing light, but the entire landscape appeared even more forbidding, remote, and haunted than it ever had before. The water, dull pewter, violently wind-lashed and bitterly cold, smashed against the massive jutting islands of rock rising out of the oceanic vastness of Lac Superieur. It froze my toughened hands, driving me almost mad with pain that I could not express in front of the Indians for fear of their reaction. Their behavior towards me had grown increasingly hostile, almost antagonistic. They now slept apart from me, and they built two fires, one for them and one for me, farther away. I ate separately from the Indians at their insistence, and never a word was passed between us now, except obligatorily, when Askewetto needed to communicate some detail of our voyage. Whatever the unfavorable sentence that had been passed upon me by the elders of the Ojibwa village where we had overnighted, it seemed that it had radically, unsympathetically, and permanently altered the Indians' view of me. Finally, we landed on a beach of smooth rock in a horseshoe-shaped inlet, just as the sun was beginning to lower in the sky. The strong, gelid wind that had raised such waves upon the surface of Lac Superieur now whipped at our bodies and faces. My clothing was wet from rogue waves over the side of the canoe, and now, on that rocky beach as we prepared to portage, I had begun to shiver violently. "When will we camp?" I asked Askewetto. I am cold and wet. Perhaps we should make camp here on the beach? Oscoweto gestured with a wide swing of his arm. There is danger, he said. It is too easy to find us here. We must go deeper into the forest. Who would find us? I said. The Iroquois? Surely we are in friendly country here. This is Ojibwa country. We are near the mission of St. Bartholomew, you said. The Ojibwa are not our enemies. From whom are we in danger? He stared at me again, that maddening, savage inscrutability. Not the Iroquois, he said, not the Ojibwa. Then he grew silent. He picked up his pack and began to carry it into the forest. All I could do was pick up my own pack and follow him. As we portaged through the woods towards St. Bartholomew, my traveling companions grew more and more apprehensive, in a way that was entirely out of character, for they had hitherto shown themselves to be fearless. It would not be incorrect to say that the Indians appeared to be at the ready, as taut as their own bowstrings, the way they might be if hunting or anticipating an attack by the Iroquois or some other enemy. At last, in the growing gloom, we laid down our packs and made camp in the clearing of a coppice of trees and set about building temporary shelter. I began to gather wood for my own fire, as I had been forced to do throughout the last week of our voyage. When I had found several stout sticks, I made as though to arrange them apart from the larger fire being built by Oscoweto and his men. The Indians regarded me strangely, though still with no hint of the amity I had known at the beginning of our voyage. It was old Hossis who spoke first, to Oscoweto. Her Algonquin was so rapid that I was unable to follow it, though the urgency of her tone was unmistakable. Her hands flew in the air as she pointed to me, then gestured around her towards the trees and the sunless sky above, then back to me. Whatever she said to him clearly gave him pause, because he told me to put my wood in the pile beside the fire that the Indians had already built and which was already burning. Hossis stared at me from where she sat, her regard almost approving. Oscoweto told me that I would remain with the rest of them tonight. Too grateful to do anything but nod, I threw my wood into the pile. The Indians reluctantly made room for me around the fire. When I say reluctantly, I mean that while they showed no overt malice or hostility, my apparent state of uncleanliness had not changed in their eyes, in spite of Oscoweto's invitation. My awareness of our complete isolation could not have been sharper than it was at that moment. Even the Ojibwa village, where I'd received such a hostile reception, seemed like an outpost of warmth and civilization compared to this wild, dark place. I needed the Indians. They did not need me. This was their world, not mine, and I was lost in it without them. Indeed, it was difficult to imagine anything human, savage, or Christian existing here. Anything could happen to me here. Indeed, to any of us. And none would be the wiser. But still, Hossis continued to stare at me, at the crucifix lying against my robe, as though it were a sorcerous talisman instead of a holy object, for I knew she had not accepted Christ. What woke me from my sleep that night, I could not say with any certainty. I had been dreaming of my family's home in France, and of my mother. In the dream, I was still a young boy in her kitchen by the fire. My mother was seated in a carved oak chair, and I on her lap, my body pressed against her soft breast as she ran her fingers through my hair. I smelled the lavender sachet from her black woolen dress beneath the starched white apron. From a massive pot on the hearth issued forth a magnificent odor of lamb stew with potatoes, vegetables, and red wine slowly cooking. The fragrance filled every corner of the room, making my mouth water. Never, I think, had I been as hungry as I was in that moment before waking. At the very moment my eyes opened on the darkness, I was already fully awake, mouth still watering, every sense alert. All about me were the general sounds of the Indian snoring and the crackle of the fire that had died to glowing embers. I smelled the smoke and the musky scent of the sleeping savages. I propped myself up on one elbow and glanced around. Nothing seemed amiss in the camp. The surrounding woods were silent as tombs, and I could see my breath in the air in front of me by firelight. I peered into the blackness, trying to ascertain what had roused me, for the sense was growing in me that I was being watched by something or someone beyond the tree line. As my eyes grew accustomed to the darkness, I thought I saw a shadow moving slyly towards us. Terror leaped in my chest, for I could think of only two things: that it could be some deadly animal, a wolf or some terrible bear, the stories of which I had heard even before boarding at Dieppe, that or an armed, bloodthirsty Iroquois scouting party. As I stared, the shadow itself divided into two smaller shadows, forms human in shape and contour. I rubbed my eyes, marveling at what I saw before me. For standing at the edge of the coppice of trees were two savage children, a girl of perhaps 9 years, holding hands with a small boy who could not have been more than 5. The girl wore a simple buckskin shift, and her arms and feet were bare in the bitter cold. The boy was completely naked, though the lower half of his face, his neck, and his upper chest appeared to be smeared with mud or some other blackish substance. I thought it a curious trick of the firelight, but even from my vantage point in the doorway, I could clearly see their eyes shining through the trees, even though their faces were deeply painted with shadow. The two children stared fixedly at our assemblage. They could have been a brother and sister on a walk through the woods on a summer day, but for the fact that, by the position of the moon in the sky, it was well past midnight, dawn hours away. And though their state of nakedness would have been tolerable in the heat of August, we were already in the mouth of winter, and yet they seemed entirely insensible to the bitter cold. The wind whipped the girl's long black hair wildly about her face, but she made no move to push it back with her hands or to cover her body against the deadly wind. The thought came to me again that I might be dreaming, for it seemed impossible that they could survive so lightly dressed in such cold, or that their appearance had not wakened Oscoetu or his men, who could practically hear the day pass into night. But no, I pinched my own face and knew I was awake. And lo, I realized that the children must be from the settlement at St. Bartholomew. If they were alive, then surely others must be also. But in this cold, I knew they would not survive, especially the naked little boy. Carefully, so as not to wake the others, I pushed back my blanket and stood up. The cold struck me at once, and with terrible force. My teeth began to clatter, and my body reacted with a violent spasm of shivering. But my only concern in that moment was for the two children. I stepped back inside and took up the blanket that had been covering me and wrapped it about me like a cloak. Carefully, I placed another log on the fire. It crackled, and then slowly caught the heat from the embers. Flames encircled it, and a plume of smoke rose into the air. From one of the packs, I took another blanket, intending to swaddle the naked little boy with it before his poor little body froze. I whispered to the children in my crude Ojibwa, indicating that they should come near the fire. I sensed, rather than saw, their response, for they stood as still as statues. And yet somehow I knew their bodies had tensed in anticipation. I beckoned with one arm, making sure to keep my own blanket wrapped about me for my own warmth. Still they stood motionless. Then slowly the girl raised her own arm and beckoned to me. The gesture was a perfect facsimile of my own, an invitation to move away from the camp and come to where she was standing. Willingly, I took a step towards her. She and the boy took a reactive step backwards, farther into the trees, but at the same time the girl beckoned me again. This time, her brother, for that is how I had come to think of him, gestured as well, as though imitating his sister's invitation to me. Then they took two more steps backward, until they were nearly invisible. I called out to them again in Ojibwa as I walked into the forest. I stared hard, straining my eyes to see where they stood. And while I could barely make out the shape of them, I again thought I saw the strange crimson firelight glow of their eyes winking in the blackness like sputtering reddish candlelight. I felt my way through the trees, occasionally colliding painfully with hard branches and stinging needles of pine. I glanced backward and saw that I had walked a considerably farther distance away from the camp than I had first thought. The whole sequence of events had taken on the qualities of a nightmare, but still I pushed through the trees in search of the naked little boy and his sister. I heard a sigh, and then soft breathing, and I looked down. The children were standing directly in front of me, silent and unmoving. I reached out my hand to touch the little boy's shoulder. His skin was unearthly cold, and it seemed a miracle to me that he could be alive, even given the legendary hardiness of these people. Unfurling the blanket I carried under my arm, I draped it as best I could around the little boy's body and drew him to me. I felt his tiny hand on my leg, stroking it as though to assure himself that I was there. From the other side, I felt his sister's hands on my other leg, her fingers moving under the blanket, like spiders along the inside of my thigh through my robe. When the child's fingers caressed my manhood with an insinuating knowledge surely beyond her years, I pulled back in shock. I reached down roughly and pushed her fingers away. What happened next must have occurred in a matter of seconds, but I remember it as though it was hours instead, and it still haunts my nightmares today. My hand was seized in a vice-like grip. It was not the grip of a little girl, though the fingers grasping mine gave every appearance of belonging to a human child. I screamed in pain, for it felt as though the bones in my hand would surely crack under the pressure. At the same moment, the gentle caress of the little boy became a heavy, vicious clamp on my thigh. A row of dagger-sharp fingernails ripped into the flesh of my leg and dug deeper, securing the little boy's grip. I screamed again, and I heard a horrible, serpentine hiss issue from the little boy's mouth. I pushed him away with all my might, but still he held fast. The little girl, too, refused to relinquish her excruciating grip on my hand. I shrieked in pain, twisted my body every way in a vain attempt to shake them off, I lost my footing and tripped, falling to the ground with the children still on top of me. The little boy's teeth, impossibly long and sharp, sank into the meat of my thigh. I screamed out to Oscar Wetto, beseeching him to come to my aid. Behind me, I thought I heard faint shouts from the Indians, but it was impossible to be certain in the din. The little girl's fingers entwined in my hair, brutally pulling my head backwards. I felt her other hand on my chest. She ripped at the blanket, clawing it as though she sought to shred it in order to expose the naked flesh of my chest underneath. I lay contorted on the ground, with the two child demons writhing on top of me, trying to push them away and calling out to God and the Indians to help me, for in that moment the two seemed interchangeable. And then her hand brushed against the crucifix I wore. A dazzling flash of blue light lit up the surrounding trees, and I smelled an awful foulness like burning flesh. The little savage girl, for I could now clearly see her in the supernatural viridian glow, leaped back into a crouching position in front of me, snarling like some cornered feral creature. Her mouth, ringed with the jagged teeth of a shark, was open in a perfect oval of agony. Peal after peal she rent the night with her torment, flailing her charred and smoking hand in the air as though to put out a fire. At the sight of his sister's injury, the little boy also relinquished his grip and scuttled away from me in a sequence of crab-like movements, taking up a cowering position behind her. His own cries of thwarted outrage blended with hers in an infernal cacophony such as I imagine must occur in the very bowels of deepest hell. She lurched forward, baring her teeth at me and spitting like a cat, but again seemed to be stopped short by my crucifix, the effect of which upon her was not unlike that which might have occurred if she had hurled herself against a stone wall. At once I heard the thunder of many feet behind me. An arrow sang past my ear and embedded itself in a tree just above where the children were crouched. The little girl glanced upwards at the arrow, then back at me, her face full of hate. Before my eyes, as if by a miracle, the demon child's body appeared to collapse upon itself, turning to smoke that blew away into the night. I saw that her brother, too, had similarly vanished, leaving in his wake that curious smoke, which appeared to move of its own volition into the forest. I stared at the spot where they had been crouching mere seconds before. For a moment, I again doubted whether or not I was dreaming, but I could feel the blood running down my leg where the little boy had bitten me. And I still felt the little girl's grip burn on my throbbing wrist. The arrow wobbled in the tree trunk, as though stirred by a strong wind. The Indians stood behind me, their terrified faces recording that they had seen the entire hellish spectacle. This comforted me, as there was part of my mind that refused to register what had just occurred. But the expression on the faces of the savages was proof to me that I had, in fact, seen the demonic spectacle, and that it had been no nightmare. But growing in me at that moment was the surety I now held the secret to the difference between faith and true knowledge. While the very existence of those two devils itself was a blasphemy, it could only be a warning from the Lord of the potent deviltry hidden in what I thought were the harmless pagan superstitions of these poor, lost people. Whatever witchcraft had been arrayed against me that night, I had defeated it with the power of Jesus Christ, through the medium of the symbol of his suffering. Triumphantly I brandished my cross at the Indians,